Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And boy, oh boy, we do get to talk to the best people. And in fact, we happen to be right now at this very moment in Orlando, Florida at VMX. That's the name of a veterinary conference. Happens to be the largest in America, a part of the North American veterinary community, and a speaker who speaks all over the world and is expert on so many things. That's important, more important to me. She's a good friend. Dr. Robin Downing, who now has, here's how I love introducing you. You have more letters after your name than you have in your name. You have so many, literally you do. I have counted. You have so many credentials. And you just got one from Chicago.
I did. I did quite recently finish my doctorate in clinical bioethics at Loyola University of Chicago at the Neiswanger Ethics Institute, which is part of the Stritch School of Medicine.
And you know, I would have been there cheering you on, but they said they wouldn't let me in because they knew who I was. So no, a limited number of people could attend.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. But what are bioethics? What did you receive this degree in? You have so many. This one I don't even understand.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair question. So clinical bioethics is really all about ethical decision-making at the bedside in a medical setting. So most often, bioethical consultation happens at the very beginning and at the very end of a patient's life. So there are ethical decisions to be made, for instance, on behalf of a neonatal patient who has been born prematurely or has multiple physical anomalies or challenges, asking the question, how far do we go in an attempt to save this baby's life? At the other end of the age spectrum, we may have someone who is very advanced in their age, who has multiple medical morbidities, who now all of a sudden has had a cascade of bad events and is facing the prospect of dying. Mm-hmm. How far do we go? And the discipline of bioethics has evolved over many decades now, really starting in the 1960s. With a physician named Edmund Pellegrino, who was a nephrologist, a kidney specialist.
Is he the guy who invented the water?
He actually is not, but nice question. And it was really Dr. Pellegrino who understood that conversations with patients and their families needed to be more than simply, I'm the doctor and I said so. And so he's one of several people who's considered really one of the fathers of what we now understand as bioethics.
Now, everything you've offered as an example so far makes sense, but is human medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this translate to veterinary medicine? Were you the first?
So another great question. In reality, there are foundational principles of clinical bioethics that absolutely apply in veterinary medicine, but have not really previously been clearly articulated as such. So we have what I call the four legs of a bioethical table, four foundational principles. The principle of autonomy, which is respecting an individual being's opportunity and ability to express preferences and really be their own person or their own being. Non-maleficence, which is the medical professional's obligation to do no harm. Non-maleficence is commonly translated as to do no harm, mm-hmm, or avoid harm. Then we have beneficence, which is a little more than just a flip side of causing no harm, is actually a positive principle around making choices that are in the patient's best interest. And then finally, the principle of justice, which translates in the veterinary realm as fairness. So this would be my obligation as a veterinarian to treat like cases alike. So, for instance, if I have a cat before me who has chronic renal disease, and 2 hours from now I see another cat with chronic renal disease, my obligation to both of those patients is to treat them in a similar fashion to the best of my ability and for the best of their opportunity to live with their disease.
Sure. So part of my question, though, are you the first veterinarian to receive this honor?
So I am, to my knowledge, the first veterinarian to actually have achieved a doctorate in clinical bioethics.
That's so cool.
But I must also pay homage to two of my colleagues who have taken ethics to a new level as veterinarians. One is Dr. Lisa Moses, who's an internist who is working with Yale University as an ethicist, and she continues to be a research ethicist for them. And my other colleague, Dr. Sheila Robertson, who is well known in the pain field and the anesthesia field.
Sure.
And she actually has now more than one credential in the realm of applying sound ethical principles to medical care for pets.
Absolutely. How does this apply to our pets? So the first of those four legs is that the person does what?
Okay. So respect.
Because the person then vocalizes what the person wants. And here's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Pets, of course, can't do that.
What a great question. And this was actually a cornerstone of my master's thesis and also one of my doctoral projects, is understanding that we in the veterinary arena need to consider our patients the same way that in human medicine, pre-verbal children are considered. The parent speaks for that pre-verbal child, but the child has an opportunity to express its preferences.
How so?
Oh, by screaming when the baby is restrained. I mean, how do we work with that child, that pre-verbal child, to better understand their preferences? So let me give you a concrete example. In the field of pediatric oncology, mm-hmm. many of those children are way beyond the ability to really comprehend what is about to come in terms of their treatment for cancer.
Of course.
And yet, they are engaged to understand what is going to happen to the best of their ability, and the physicians, nurses, and parents work within those expressed preferences.
So here's what I will ask you when we come back. The difference between that and dogs and cats is, and there's, you love data, that much I know about you, there's data to suggest that we understand, no surprise, our babies better than we do, as much as we understand dogs and cats, better than we do dogs and cats. So how do we know what those dogs and cats would say? She will tell us when we come back on WGN. I think they call it imposter syndrome when you're talking to someone whose level is way above your head. She's my friend, though. Dr. Robin Downing is here with all those degrees, her latest from Loyola, right here in Chicago, as a bioethicist. And we're talking at the first in veterinary medicine to receive such an honor. You worked to get this honor, but nevertheless, it's an honor. You were the first, you know. Do you hope others follow?
I would love to be the point of the spear to really open the door for colleagues in veterinary medicine to better understand the principles of clinical bioethics and how those principles can, in fact, and should apply within the context of our veterinary client-patient relationship.
You know, one example that you gave, you and I've had the honor to speak with you many times at veterinary meetings, and one example that you gave when talking about declaw in cats is, do you think, these aren't maybe your exact words, but they're close, do you think if you asked cats that they would ever say, yes, I want this elective amputation to happen to me?
And of course, my answer is I'm pretty confident they would decline the opportunity. What's interesting is that we actually now have a fair amount of neural research.
But is that an example?
Oh, that's a great example.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be a great example of bioethics at work, because asking the question, what would be this pet's preference? So expressed preferences, when we talk about nonverbal beings, and when I say nonverbal, I mean they don't speak the same language we do. They speak their own language. They just don't speak a language that we necessarily understand.
I think that's important, because always our pets are communicating with us.
Absolutely.
We may not pick up on what they're saying. And as much as we understand dogs, it's a line I use constantly. I'm sure you've heard me say it, that dogs understand us better.
Yeah.
So as smart as we are, we're still not quite getting everything that they're telling us. I digress a little bit.
Go ahead. That's okay, because I think that's a really important nuanced way of understanding that when we talk about respecting a pet's autonomy by way of respecting their preferences to the best of our ability, sometimes there is something that we as medical professionals need versus want. And when we need something, we may have to proceed over the objection of our patient. But to give you a tangible example, for instance, there are ways that a pet would express preferences to us. So I may have a dog who would prefer that I not draw a blood sample from the jugular vein, even though that is a very easy place for me to take a sample of blood. Their preference may be that I would use the cephalic vein on the front leg, or even the saphenous vein on the rear leg, because for that particular patient, for that particular dog, the restraint involved for me to take a sample from a limb is much less invasive to that particular dog than the way that we need to position them to take a sample from the jugular vein, as one example.
And is that why you're such a fan of fear-free?
And of course, I believe that fear-free principles align very nicely with bioethical principles.
And let's explain what fear-free is, because we can't assume people know.
Fear-free is taking the pet out of petrified and putting the treat into treatment. And actually engaging that animal patient to participate in their own care in a cooperative fashion to the best of their ability and to the best of my ability.
Which also is what's happening in dog training at the same time, called consent. It's all kind of intersecting, isn't it?
It actually is intersecting. And it's interesting that you would choose to use the word consent, because consent actually is not as accurate a term for what we are pursuing with that individual pet. What the preferred term is assent. They assent to do what we are asking them to do.
I thought that's when you climb a mountain.
Different spelling.
No.
It's a homonym, but not a synonym. I'm an English major. What can I say?
Okay.
Back to assent versus consent. Consent actually implies a level of intellectual capacity that we cannot presume that our patients have, because they do not speak the same language we do. But they can assent to allow us to cooperate with what we need to do with them, as opposed to what we do to them.
That is just, it's... Now I have to change a talk that I give around just a little bit because of what you just said, actually. All right, so getting back to bioethics, which is what we were talking about. We were talking about cutting off the claws, but it's more than cutting off the claws of cats, which you will explain, but how this is a good example of what you were talking about.
Okay. I think this is great, and thank you for giving me the opportunity. So this term declaw is a sanitized term that describes amputating the last digit of each toe of a cat.
And that's literally what it is.
And that is absolutely literally what it is. And so I certainly am advocating that my profession take a serious look at reframing, rebranding, re-changing how we speak to actually call it what it is, which is feline toe amputation. Now, when we think about the four foundational principles of clinical bioethics, let's look at autonomy first. Respect for autonomy means respecting an individual being's preferences. And I have used this illustration that should we actually be able to speak a language cats understand and ask them, would you be willing to allow us to amputate the last digit of each of your toes, which is an excruciatingly painful proposition that portends lots of pain in the future that will be very difficult to manage. I'm reasonably confident that a rational being of any intellectual capacity would be willing to say no to that. Then we have the principle of non-maleficence. Do no harm. Does it harm a cat to lose the last digit of each toe? And of course, we know that yes, it does. It changes the biomechanics of the entire body, and it changes their nervous system and their potential experience of pain.
So those are two of the four pillars. We have two more to go. We will talk about them, and we'll talk more about bioethics. I mean, this is a fascinating conversation. I'm not surprised that it is. We're talking with Dr. Robin Downing. We happen to be at the VMX Veterinary Conference in Orlando, Florida. You're from Denver. I'm from Chicago. At the moment, we're nice and warm. When we come back on WGN. I've talked about this before, xylitol, that's X-Y-L-I-T-O-L, that's how it's spelled. How would that be pronounced? Xylitol? But it's pronounced xylitol. In any case, it's really bad. Keep this stuff away from your dog. The thing is, now it's very confusing because you look for, as I've talked about, look for xylitol on the label in anything that might have a sugar substitute. For example, peanut butter. Now you have to look also for birch sugar. It's the same exact thing. Why in the world it is sometimes called birch sugar and sometimes called xylitol? I don't have a clue, but I do know this. Dogs instantly just about, can suffer kidney failure as a result. So anything that has xylitol in it, from brownie mixes that are for diabetics to breath mints, and the list goes on, please keep it away from your dogs. Back on WGN Radio with Dr. Robin Downing, who is extraordinarily respected in veterinary medicine and has a degree that no one else in veterinary medicine has in bioethics, among your many, 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 many degrees. What motivates you? You are always learning.
So I am a lifelong learner, and I am ADD, and I choose not to take meds. So there must always be something on the horizon, and I always see things on the horizon that I feel I must pursue.
What motivated you to pursue this?
So my mother, when she died from advanced ovarian cancer, experienced what I referred to as hashtag best death ever. She was nearly 2 weeks in an in-hospital hospice at the end of her life as her ovarian cancer overtook her body. And I had the opportunity as a pain expert to partner with the medical director of the hospice program to provide my mother with the answer to her deathbed request of me as not just her daughter, but as a medical expert. She asked me to help her be comfortable and lucid until she could be neither of those things. And that meant that I needed to act as her medical advocate and to work with the medical director of the hospice to escalate my mother's pain management needs, her pain management treatments, as her need for increased pain management evolved as she became closer and closer to her death. I am so grateful forever to Dr. Patty Mayer, who was that medical director, who allowed me to basically intervene on my mother's behalf in ways that were just a little bit different from how another patient might have been managed without such strong advocacy. And when my mother did die, she lost consciousness, lost her ability to be comfortable and lucid only 12 hours before her death. And she was able to take care of her last requests and wishes with her family. She was able to see all but two of her siblings. The two siblings who could not be present at her deathbed were physically unable to travel, and that's why they weren't there.
Yeah.
She made the kinds of resolutions and the kinds of reconciliations that I think we all aspire to as we bring our lives to a close. That experience cemented to me that there is a need, well recognized in human medicine, that human beings want to die well. We express that as a culture, that we want to die peacefully, and yet the majority of individuals die in a hospital setting or an ICU setting with tremendous contention. And I felt called to actually create a path for myself into human medicine to advocate not just on behalf of beings who cannot advocate for themselves, like my patients, but to advocate on behalf of human beings who want to die well and need that support in order for that to happen. Physicians have an aversion to using the D word, dying, and it is amazing to me that bioethicists have come on the scene as those individuals who can help facilitate the conversation around an individual's need and desire to die well. And they call bioethicists the strangers at the bedside, because most often clinical bioethicists are not longtime participants in the patient's care. They may not even be medical professionals. But as a veterinarian, I have facilitated so many challenging conversations around the death of my patients, the impending death, the not that immediate impending death, the we need to make a crisis decision today because your pet is going to die in the next 24 hours. Those are such challenging conversations. And yet, over and over and over, veterinarians have those conversations. I felt called to leverage those skills and to leverage that experience on behalf of my fellow human beings.
We were talking about an example of what we're talking about, which is declaw and cats. And we got to two legs of the table. What are the other two?
So the other two legs are beneficence and justice, and or fairness. And part of the reason we're having this conversation about cats and feline toe amputation is that before I turn my attention exclusively to work in human medicine in the end-of-life space with people who are facing challenging decisions for themselves and their human family members, I feel so strongly that I need to provide my current profession and my current colleagues with a formal framework within which to make difficult decisions around how much intervention, how much technology should be leveraged for our patients. So, feline toe amputation and beneficence. Beneficence is really hinges on doing what is best for the patient. So, what is in the patient's best interest? Asking a cat, looking at a cat objectively, am I bringing good to the cat by amputating the last digit of their toes and creating problems for them. So way beyond just avoiding the harm of causing pain and disfigurement, I now need to act on that cat's behalf, in that cat's best interest. It's in their best interest to be an intact body. And finally, fairness. Is it fair for me to create a potential disability in one of my patients? And I would argue that the answer is no.
So the bioethics for animals means that you're kind of putting yourself, if they could speak, and what is right and wrong? Have I got that right?
So that actually is at the heart of it. And really, that position of what is right for this patient must be informed by the veterinarian's medical expertise and discernment about what is best for an individual patient.
We'll be back with more with the one and only Dr. Robin Downing on WGN. We are talking about all sorts of different topics, including clinical bioethics. What's that? With Dr. Robin Downing, who now has yet another degree among your many. Can we talk about how many? Do you know how many?
Well, formal degrees.
Yeah.
I have a Bachelor's of Art in English from Loyola.
Chicago.
At Chicago.
You're from Chicago.
And it's actually an artist's baccalaureatus because it was an artist's baccalaureatus.
Can't even say that.
Because the Jesuits actually provide their degrees in Latin. So what is a BA for everyone else, Bachelor of Arts, is an AB for the Jesuits who confer the degree in Latin.
Okay.
So I have an AB. And then I have a BSV for Bachelor of Science in Veterinary Medicine, the DVM, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, a Master's of Science in Clinical Bioethics, and a Doctor of Bioethics. The Master's of Science from Mount Sinai School of Medicine and what was at that time Union Graduate College, now part of the Clarkson University system. The DBE, Doctor of Bioethics, from the Neiswanger Institute at Loyola University of Chicago Stritch School of Medicine.
And you have some specialties in veterinary medicine as well.
I have a few of those as well.
Yeah, it's just incredible. As I said earlier, more letters after your name than in your name, quite literally.
Sorry. That actually makes me laugh quite a bit.
All right. So one of your expertises is pain and dealing with pain. And it does tie in with bioethics because we don't want our animals to be painful as pet parents. But it's the right thing to do to treat pain, I imagine, in any living being.
That is absolutely true. So one of the seminal authors who really influenced my thinking, both in pain management and pain medicine and in bioethics, is an Englishman named Richard Ryder, who wrote a seminal work called Painism. And in that work, Painism, Richard introduced into the lexicon a term painient, and painient expresses the reality of any being who is capable of experiencing pain. And he went on to affirm that pain and suffering often coexist, and reducing and minimizing suffering involves both taking care of pain and creating opportunity for that being to be restored to as complete a sense of wholeness as possible.
And it turns out that if we have a headache, we take a pill. You know, if we have fill in the blank, we take a pill, actually. And I'm not knocking the pills or the pharmaceuticals, but we can do more. Although the pharmaceutical may be a good idea.
Correct. So in reality, what we know now, and this is one area where veterinary medicine is now actually influencing human medicine, as you know, often veterinary medicine follows the lead of human medicine. But here is an example of human medicine being able to benefit from veterinary medicine, because in veterinary medicine, we understand that managing our patient's pain is best accomplished through what we call a multimodal pain management strategy. And the visual that I try to give my clients is the patient is like the hub of a wheel. And each modality that I bring to help that animal not be in pain and to be maximally functional is like a spoke on the wheel. So pharmaceuticals, as you state, are very important in that multimodal plan. So I do need to rely on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, for instance, in the initial stages of building that multimodal pain management strategy.
But not all animals also can take that, because there may be other conditions, they may be older animals, et cetera.
Well,
and for cats, that's tough. I'm getting there.
That's okay.
Go.
So I almost without exception, I can safely use a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug for a short period to make a huge dent in that animal's pain experience right at the beginning. But then I have to layer other modalities on board, like utilizing another pharmacology agent, gabapentin, for instance, to help re-educate a maladapted nervous system not to perpetuate pain without any organic cause. I'm going to use non-pharmaceutical elements in my pain management strategy. What is important to me as a veterinarian is to be able to choose a nutritional supplement that provides pain relief and or joint support in a patient who is chronically painful from arthritis. I'm going to look for an agent to add to my plan that has been demonstrated in clinical studies to be efficacious. It makes no sense for me to use something that isn't going to contribute to that patient's comfort. Then we shift to physical medicine. And here we have a plethora of opportunities. Medical acupuncture provides neuromodulation that can really change the pain experience. There are multiple physical medicine, physical therapy modalities that I, as a board-certified sports medicine and rehabilitation specialist, can leverage on behalf of my patient. But there are many, many strategies that a veterinarian can utilize that doesn't require for them to leave their practice to learn. But we also have things like adapting the physical environment, making certain that we pay attention to where are the food and water dishes? Should that animal have unlimited access to stairs? What about the comfort of a bed for them to sleep and sleep well during the night? And then finally, understanding that there are assistive devices that can be leveraged on that pet's behalf to maintain mobility, to maintain function, like wheelchairs that just partially support the body weight, allowing them to continue to use all four legs, but just like a human would use a walker or a cane, supportive vests that allow the pet parent to gently assist that pet getting up and down from a standing to a laying, from a laying to a standing position. The options are so many and so exciting, and each plan is different because each pet is different.
Well, what's so exciting for me? Talking to you. It is always exciting to do. Truly, you are amazing. Dr. Robin Downing, as always, thank you so much. A stimulating conversation. This has been, as it always is, it's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
So here's the thing that happened with veterinary care during the pandemic. So many veterinarians, and it happened with our own care, right? We didn't want to go in to see the doctor unless we really needed to, and the doctors didn't want us to come in. So we did it all on our computers or maybe iPads, but we did it virtually. And the same thing happened with our pets. Now, veterinary medicine was gradually beginning to move in that space anyway, but then pow, bang, zoom, the pandemic hit. And everyone was getting veterinary care virtually. Now, at the same time, all these companies popped up and said, okay, we can provide that care for you. We don't know you. We don't know your pet, but we know veterinary medicine at least well enough to help you. And it seemed at first, I was on board. I thought, okay, that's not a bad idea. But as it turns out, it is a bad idea. Not virtual care, that's a good idea. But with a veterinary professional who knows your pet. Now, the American Veterinary Medical Association conducted a survey, and it turned out 88% of pet owners agree that having the veterinarian physically examine their pet and talk to them in person leads to the best care. But the same percent get it. They say, okay, I have no problem with virtual care if it is a veterinary professional that happens to know my pet, where the record is right there. So you could see the history, probably has examined my pet before. That 88% agree with is a good idea. So here's what I'm saying. Before you jump at the notion of these third-party or direct-to-consumer providers, because it's inexpensive or it's immediate, think about virtual care with your own veterinary professional first, or just see your veterinarian. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.